unworkable autocratic system thrust upon him. Period. That simple. You know, Tsar Nikolai and Comrade Lenin were like two great trains running toward each other at a colossal speed. The closer they came, the faster they went. They were traveling, however, on two entirely different sets of tracks, and so they should have passed by each other. They should have missed completely and zoomed on, racing toward their remarkable but very different destinations and goals, and yet they collided head-on with a great, terrible force, killing millions upon millions around them. And do you know why these two trains that were on two different sets of tracks collided so terribly? Because it was their fate, their destiny. And not just theirs alone, but all of Russia's. Forgive me, it's true. I wander in my heart and my thoughts. Such is the curse of any emigrant, to abandon one's home and never find another, to always flounder in a sea of remorse. Your dear grandmother handled it much better than I, but then again, she was a far superior person in so many ways. Well, then, fate marched on. Later that day, the Romanovs had the real Abednitsa, a liturgy without communion, their first in 3 months. Alexandra arranged a small altar all by herself, draping one of her shawls on a table, setting out her images, her treasured icons, and then surrounding them with birch tree branches. It was lovely in its simplicity. And she and the daughters sang quite nicely. Father Storozhev, in fact, came, and while we were all wondering if he might bring a note, or news of some kind, there was nothing. Nor could there have been, because the priest was escorted in by Commandant Avdeev, who never left his side. And then? Well, later in the day, the girls darned various linens with Nyuta, then helped their mother arrange their medicines, for this was an ongoing affair, their hiding of the last of their jewels. While the two suitcases of larger gems had been secretly left with the nuns in Tobolsk, you only have to peruse the last pages of Alexandra's diary to see evidence of their clandestine stitching of the smaller diamonds. Arranged things all day, tattered. Tatiana sewed my J. Arranged medicines with Yevgeny Sergeyevich. Arranged things, tattered, heart enlarged. Arranged things, tattered, red. Finally, on the morning of July 16th, slightly more than 12 hours before they were all slaughtered, the long secret task was complete. In the final journal entry of her life, the very one where she mentions how I was taken away, Alexandra simply noted, "Olga and I arranged our medicines." You see, it took the careful hands of all six women, the Tsaritsa, the four Grand Duchesses, as well as the maid, weeks to finish with the 42,000 carats, and doing so with precious little time to spare, as if they had sensed the hour of death was upon them. By noon of that day, all the jewels were wrapped in cotton wadding, then packed and stitched ever so tightly into the double corsets of those beautiful girls, which, of course, proved such a horrible mistake. The Tsar spent the rest of the day reading, pacing, and smoking at the open window. Later, he had a sitting bath. I myself brought him hot water from the kitchen. Later, he played bridge with his girls and bezique with Yevgeny Sergeyevich. And thus, shortly after 10, concluded the 23rd, a day which ended much more quietly than it had begun. Did I say it was a Sunday? I shall pass quickly over the 24th, which was fraught with tension only in so much as nothing happened. Yevgeny Sergeyevich remained in bed the entire day, as did the Empress, complaining yet again of an enlarged heart and aching eyes. Later, actually, she moved nearby the open window, where she read and played cards with Maria Nikolaevna. About this time, toward 1 o'clock, the rest of us were allowed into the garden. There we paced for 40 minutes. The heat was tropical. Outside, in the full of sun, the temperature rose to 37.5 degrees, while inside the thick walls of the Ipatyev house, it climbed only to a warm 21.5. Otherwise, we waited and hoped, but once again Sister Antonina and her novice failed to appear. I couldn't help but think that either the nun had been discovered, or the supposed friends of the Tsar and his family had lost their nerve and abandoned us. Although no one else spoke of such doubts, I am sure everyone else felt them, for anxiety hung in the air like thick fog. Tuesday, the 25th, began as the other recent days, warm and monotonous. Yevgeny Sergeyevich was feeling better from his attack of the kidneys, but he remained in bed nevertheless. After breakfast, I wheeled about the air, room to room, as was my usual morning duty. We were just passing from the main parlor back into the dining room when both Alexei Nikolaevich and I heard voices from beyond the double-closed doors. The guard room lay there, and I could hear deep, distrustful voices of the men and a single small one that was full of morning brightness. Unable to contain his excitement, the heir twisted in the wheeling chaise, looked up at me, and whispered, "That's Sister Antonina." "Das." I turned the chair around, aiming it toward the double doors, and the heir clasped his hands in his lap and eagerly bent forward. I half expected Jim, the huge Negro from America, who'd been a fixture at the Alexander Palace right up until the first days of the Revolution, to swing open the door with his usual great pomp. Instead, however, one of the guards shoved open the door with his foot. "Пять минут." "5 minutes," one of them ordered. "No more."
"Of course, my son."
Draped from head to foot in folds of black, the sister entered, her head bowed slightly as she tried to conceal a smile. She carried an open woven basket, in which were nestled brown eggs, a good 10 of them, and immediately behind her trailed novice Marina, who clutched 2 chetvert of milk in her arms. Upon seeing the heir, both women stopped still, crossed themselves, and the sister, her head bowed, said, "Доброе утро, Алексей Николаевич." "Good morning." Until recently, Alexei had always been greeted so reverently, and he thought nothing of it. With a great deal of enthusiasm and curiosity, he looked upon them and nodded to the basket. "I see you've brought me more eggs." Sister Antonina, her eyes fixed firmly on the ground before her young master, gave a polite, "Das." "And milk did you bring?" I heard not a sound from behind, for his worn brown boots moved with great stealth. Before I knew it, Nikolai Alexandrovich stepped in, scooted me aside, and took hold of the wheeling chaise. In a single gentle movement, the Tsar spun it and the air around. "We must not interrupt their work, Alyosha," said father to son. "But we'll let Leonka deal with the food. After all, he is the cook's assistant. Now, how about the game of dominoes?" Only after the Tsar and Tsarevich disappeared into the dining room and beyond did Sister Antonina and the novice Marina raise their eyes and heads. Looking upon me with a proud, beaming smile, the sister stepped forward and kissed me, peasant style, that is to say, 3 times on my cheeks. As she embraced me so warmly, I glanced over her shoulder and saw that Marina was looking on, staring at me, as if I were some kind of godly hero. At the tail end of the 3rd kiss, Sister Antonina whispered into my ear, "Молодец." "Excellent." The diminutive sister was musty with the unmistakable perfume of orthodoxy, so smoky and sweet, and I pulled back, took the basket from her hand. "Here, allow me."
And so it was that the sister and novice followed me out of the parlor, through the dining room, back around, and into the little makeshift kitchen. Cook Karitonov stood at the counter peeling potatoes, and he eyed us over his shoulder. "Again we have brought you the freshest of eggs," began Sister Antonina, "as well as milk still warm from the cow. Marina herself helped with the milking." With that, the young girl stepped forward, handing me one glass bottle in particular and placing the other on the table. She looked at me, blushing as her eyes caught on mine. "We will be back as soon as possible," said Sister Antonina. I handed the novice the bottle they'd previously brought, now empty, of course, and escorted them through the dining room and into the parlor. Sister Antonina rapped once on the doors, one of which was opened, and the two women disappeared. While Kharatinov, potato in hand, kept a seemingly loose eye on the door for a guard, I pulled the stopper from the very bottle Marina had placed in my hands. And that was where the second note from the officer was found. The note that, to this day, lies with the others in the archive of the Russian Federation in Moscow. Later that summer, in an attempt to hide their crimes, the Bolsheviki frantically took all such documents, diaries, photo albums, letters, as well as the secret rescue notes, upon their evacuation of Yekaterinburg. But back then, on the 25th, the morning thereof, hope seemed to be burning bright yet again. All of the Romanovs likewise supposed that there was a note in that milk bottle, and they were eager to know its contents. Within moments of the departure of the sister and her novice, the Tsaritsa's maid was at the door of the kitchen. "Would you be so kind," said Demidova, "as to fulfill Alexandra Fyodorovna's request for a glass of water?"
"Certainly," replied Cook Kharitonov.
Of course, I was the one to fulfill the so-called request, because such trivial tasks always fell upon me, little Lyonka. And so, clutching the folded note in my hand, I went to the crock of water that we always kept on the wooden counter. I gently pulled off the cloth covering the top and ladled the glass, and then, turning to Demidova, I handed her the water. As I did so, I slipped the note from my palm into hers. She smiled, her head bobbed in appreciation, and she quickly stuffed the note up the long sleeve of her dress. Immediately she turned to go, but just as quickly Kharitonov spoke out. "Would you be so kind as to tell the others," said the cook, gazing deep into Demidova's eyes, "that only soup and vermicelli will be served at lunch? There will be no meat until dinner. The commandant himself told me that Lyonka will not be allowed to go to the Soviet for more cutlets until 3.
"I see."
Actually, what she said was "Yasna," which has a very rich meaning in Russian, because, of course, Russian is a much richer, not to mention more beautiful tongue than English, which is so hard-sounding and so rigid in its complex rules. "Yasna" doesn't simply mean "I see," nor does it simply mean "it's clear" or "I understand." Нет. That single word says something infinitely more profound. What it implies is that one understands not simply the meaning of the word, but also what lies beneath the surface yet cannot be spoken. It lays out the true, complex dynamics of a situation. In other words, Demidova understood not the day's menu, for that was not the message at all, but that she needed to convey to the Tsar and Tsaritsa that if they wanted to reply to this note, they needed to have that reply finished by 3 so I could take it when I went out for meat. So, the note was delivered to the Tsar and his anxious empress. At the time, I was not privy to its contents, nor to the discussions within the family thereof. I don't know what Nikolai and Alexandra talked of. Oh, sure, I glimpsed the words of the note when I took it out of the bottle stopper, but this one was in French, too. I could not make out a word. Translated, however, the June 25th, 1918 note sent to the Romanovs reads thus: "With the help of God and your sang-froid, we hope to succeed without taking any risk. One of your windows must be unglued so that you can open it at the right time. Indicate which window, please. The fact that the little Tsarevich cannot walk complicates matters, but we have taken that into account, and I don't think it will be too great an inconvenience. Write if you need two people to carry him in their arms, or if one of you can take care of that. If you know the exact time in advance, is it possible to make sure the little one will be asleep for 1 or 2 hours before the escape? The doctor must give his opinion, but in case of need, we can provide something for that. Do not worry. No attempt will be made without being absolutely sure of the result. Before God, before history, and before our conscience, we give you this solemn promise. An officer. Although at that time I didn't know what was said specifically in the second letter, it soon became apparent that our rescuers were progressing with their plan and circling ever closer toward our salvation. Sure, I perceived this, because the entire imperial family took on an air of near gaiety, a lighter tone, such that was otherwise seen only when the heir was in good health and spirits. And just as I was not witness to the Tsar reading the note, nor was I witness to him replying to it. I assumed then, as I still do to this day, that they commenced a reply almost at once, because for the rest of the morning, while I busied myself helping Kharitonov, all the Romanovs were busy with their books and their diaries and their letters. Da, they wrote a good many letters from their captivity to Nikolai's mama, the dowager, or as she was referred to, the older empress, who was under house arrest in the Crimea, as well as letters to Alexander's sister, Grand Duchess Ella, the nun, who was under arrest not far away in Alapayevsk, and to their friends like Anna Virobova and the such. That was how things appeared for the rest of the morning, business as usual. They went to great lengths to make it appear so. Several of the children even studied, too, including Olga Nikolaevna, who at one point took her writing tablet, a French novel, and her French-Russian dictionary to her father for his assistance.
"Papa, I'm having trouble with this translation. Would you help me?"
"With pleasure, Dochka moya, my little daughter." It seemed so natural that the Tsar would help his daughter with French. Nikolai, of course, spoke beautiful proper Russian and very nice English and French. But never German. No, I never heard him or his bride speak the language of her native land. So, Nikolai and his eldest daughter disappeared into his bedchamber, ostensibly to study her French novel, but surely to compose a speedy reply to the officer's note. Alexandra was there too. Having returned to bed after the morning inspection because her head ached, she sat propped up, stitching away on her medicines as they composed their response, which was complete by 1 when luncheon was served. This I know, because as the Tsar came into the dining room, he sought me out, resting his hand on my shoulder, which he squeezed in a kindly, most fatherly manner.
"Lyonka, would you be so kind as to assist me after the meal?"
To distract attention, he quickly added, "I would like to move my writing table in order to take better advantage of the evening sunlight."
"Das,"
I replied with a slight bow of my head. We were all present for the meal, including Alexandra Fyodorovna, whose head had cleared, not because of a decrease in barometric pressure, but most likely because of the uplifting news. As always, we shared the same table, master and servant, and we all did our best to ignore rank. Well, our midday meal was indeed a thin cabbage soup, followed by a second course of vermicelli sprinkled with dillweed. And after we had eaten and Demidova and I had cleared the table, I immediately went to the Tsar's bedchamber, finding it occupied by both my master and mistress. "How may I assist you, Nikolai Alexandrovich?" I asked, standing in the doorway with my hands folded before me.
"Ah, Lyonka, excellent."
He gazed at me with those remarkable eyes, then winked, which gave my heart a start. "I just realized this morning that the evening light would be much better for writing if I situated my table a bit to the left. After all, The electric lamps have not been so reliable as of late.
No,
they most definitely hadn't. Not only was the power supply from the city dam most unreliable, so was the wiring of the house itself. Just last week, several electricians had spent 2 whole days trying to correct the problem. From the cushioned chair where she sat, needle in hand, Alexandra Fyodorovna said in a distinctly loud voice, "Lyonka, I have a small present for the father who gave us the obednica yesterday." She held up a small handkerchief on which she was stitching the twice-transversed cross of Russian Orthodoxy. "I wonder if you would be so kind as to drop it by the church the next time you go for food."
"With pleasure, madame. I am to go this afternoon."
"How convenient. I shall be finished within the half hour."
The Tsar glanced toward the door, saw no guard, then reached for a book on his table. He flipped through the pages, coming to the very note the sister had brought earlier, and withdrew it. "Hide this on your body, young man. Our response is written on the same note," he said, his voice low. "Do it now. Place it in your undergarments." I did as ordered, opening my clothes and hiding the note on my body. As I buttoned up my pants, I looked up.
"You know what to do?" he asked.
Speaking words that the Yekaterinburg Soviet had strictly forbidden, I replied in a hushed voice, "Das, Vashe Velichestva." "Yes, your greatness." The Tsar and I then played out the charade of moving the writing table, a fine piece of polished wooden furniture with a green leather top, and then I retreated. Toward 2:30, they all went out into the garden, including Yevgeny Sergeyevich, who was greatly improved. They all went out except the Empress and one of her daughters, the second, Tatiana Nikolaevna. They remained indoors, where they conducted their spiritual readings, Daniel 16 to the end, as well as Hosea 1 to 5. This I know because the Empress herself told me, whispering that she would be praying for me. And so it was that after I helped the Tsar's footman, Trap, carry the wheeling chaise down into the garden, and after the Tsar himself carried down his 14-year-old son, I returned to the kitchen. Shortly thereafter, I was escorted out of the locked rooms, past the guards, through the double palisades, and out the gates into the square of the Church of the Ascension. It never occurred to me to run, to flee, not then nor any other time. I don't know why, but somewhere in my heart, I felt my place was in there, with them, in that house that was so full of evil intent. Well, that afternoon, I again fulfilled my task. I encountered no problems. As instructed, I stopped by the church and delivered the handkerchief embroidered by the Empress herself. And I handed over the note dictated by the Emperor and handwritten by his daughter, Olga Nikolaevna. I gave it to Father Storozhev, and it reads, "The second window from the corner facing the square has been opened for 2 days, day and night. The 7th and 8th windows facing the square next to the main entrance are always open. The room is occupied by the commandant and his aides, who are also the inside guards, up to 13 at least, armed with rifles, revolvers, and bombs. None of the doors have keys except ours. The commandant or his aides come into our room whenever they want. The one who is on duty does the outside rounds twice every hour of the night, and we hear him chatting with the sentry beneath our windows. There is a machine gun on the balcony and another downstairs in case of alarm. If there are others, we do not know about them. Do not forget that we have the doctor, a maid, 2 men, and a little boy who is a cook with us. It would be ignoble of us, although they do not want to inconvenience us, to leave them alone after they have followed us voluntarily into exile. The doctor has been in bed for 3 days with kidney trouble, but he is getting better. We are constantly awaiting the return of our men, Ivan Sednyov and Clementi Nagorny, young and robust, who have been shut up in the city for a month. We do not know where or why. In their absence, the little one is carried by his father in order to move about the rooms or go into the garden. Our surgeon, Derivenka, who comes almost daily at 5 o'clock to see the little one, lives in the city. Do not forget, we never see him alone. The guards are in a little house across from our 5 windows on the other side of the street, 50 men. The only things that we still have are in crates in the shed in the interior courtyard. We are especially worried about AF number 9, a small black crate, and a large black crate, number 13NA, with his old letters and diaries. Naturally, the bedrooms are filled with crates, beds, and things, all at the mercy of the thieves who surround us. All the keys, and separately number 9, are with the commandant, who has behaved well enough toward us. In any case, warn us if you can, and answer if you can also bring our people. In front of the entrance, there is always an automobile. There are bells at each sentry post, in the commandant's room, and some wires also go to the guardhouse and elsewhere. If our other people remain, can we be sure that nothing will happen to them? Dr. B begs you not to think about him and the other men so that the task will not be more difficult. Count on the 7 of us and the woman. May God help you. You can count on our sang-froid. And here I must pause in my story. 8. Misha pushed the stop button on his tape recorder, listened as the little machine clicked to a halt, and then sat back in his leather desk chair. The old man took a deep breath, held it, and finally exhaled. From this vantage, Lake Forest, Illinois, and this time, August 1998, it was all going fine, wasn't it? He was telling the story just as he should, right? Oh, how he wished May were here. She would know. His wife, who always had a word on her tongue, would tell him whether or not he was saying too much, too little, or if he was getting it just right. Boże mój, my God. How he couldn't wait until this life was over. He pushed back his chair, grabbed a hold of the edge of his desk, hesitated, and pushed himself to his feet. Then, he just stood there. Everything used to be so automatic. Now he had to think about every little step. He started to move his left leg, but then a bolt of pain stabbed his bad knee. Wincing, he leaned on the desk with one hand, hesitated, tried again. It was always like this. At first walking seemed impossible, but after the first few steps he seemed to be able to walk out of it. And so he proceeded. He'd always been amazed that the slaughtered bodies of the Romanovs had remained hidden for so many, many years. And in fact he had often wondered if they'd ever be found, particularly within his own lifetime. And it wasn't until July 11th, 1991, the day after Boris Yeltsin's inauguration, that a squadron of detectives, colonels, epidemiologists, and forensic experts headed out of Yekaterinburg toward the village Kaptiki. It was there, behind a fence, underneath a tent, and in the glare of all these lights, that the herd of Russian officials pulled more than 1,000 smashed and crushed bones out of the mud. Even then, they weren't sure what they found. Seeking the truth, but lacking DNA technology, the Russian scientists developed a sophisticated technique of computerized superimposition, whereby their mathematicians matched photos of the Romanovs to the skulls they found. And that was how, Misha had read, they determined that skull number 4, the very one that contained a desiccated brain shriveled to the size of a pear, was none other than Tsar Nikolai. Skull number 7, meanwhile, proved the easiest to identify because of its extensive and beautiful dental work. It was that of the Empress Alexandra. Ah, thought Misha, crossing the broad living room, as the saying goes, there exists no secret that will not be revealed. And those broken and bizarrely crushed bones found in that shallow grave quickly told the story that the deaths had not only been violent, but grossly brutal, which was absolutely correct, because, of course,
Misha had seen it all with his own eyes. The most shocking thing the Russian specialist discovered, however, was what they didn't find. The bodies of both the Heir Tsarevich Alexei and Grand Duchess Maria. And so, that was his job, Misha's. Now, it was up to him to tell why the bodies of two Romanovs were still missing. His story, his truth, was what he would leave behind, and it would be, he was certain, the definitive truth that would stand for decades, if not centuries. So sad, thought Misha as he hobbled along, so terribly sad. Not just the murder of the imperial family, but that the hatred of the Russian Revolution proved so barbaric and violent. Slava Bogu, thanks to God that at least the Romanovs had finally been laid to rest in an Orthodox service just last month in Sankt Petersburg. Misha had procured a videotape of the funeral, and May and he had watched it over and over, all of which filled them both with a sense of peace. And then, a mere 3 weeks after the funeral in Petersburg, May herself had died, content with the knowledge that the revolution that had burned across their homeland was done and over. With a heaviness that had hung from his heart since that night so long ago, Misha went about his business. He visited the downstairs powder room just off the central hall, and then briefly headed into the kitchen, where he poured himself a glass of water. Carrying the glass, he returned via the butler's pantry, a narrow room filled with stacks of fine china and rows of crystal glasses. As he pushed open the swinging door into the dining room and gazed upon the massive mahogany table, he was reminded of all the fancy dinner parties they'd hosted. Here had dined not only the creme de la creme of Midwestern aristocracy, the Wrigleys, Walgreens, Swifts, Cranes, Maytags, and so many more, but also such international luminaries as Walt Disney, Ella Fitzgerald, Catherine Hepburn, and even the Prince of Wales. But it had all been a lie. He'd convinced all of Chicago society that he'd not only bought an immense amount of stock for practically nothing at the very bottom of the Depression, but that he'd been one of the first investors in IBM, buying what would become a fortune in stock for just pennies. So that everyone would think him of good breeding, Misha himself had planted the rumor that his parents were minor aristocrats who had been horrendously slaughtered by the Bolsheviki. And then Misha moved into a new life in America, going through the motions of great happiness, buying this huge house, playing golf at the exclusive Onwencia Club, and throwing extravagant parties, yet it had all meant nothing. Nothing. No. Everything that he saw was in the context of how ugly, how cruel was this world and its human race. Try as he wanted, Misha could barely love even his own boy, that which his own seed created. He made an effort, sometimes with success, to care for his Peter, but every time he gazed into his face, he saw but one thing, his own reflection. Absolutely, mused Misha, as he moved through the room. In his own child, he saw living proof that he had survived. And it was almost more than he could bear, for Misha had never been able to escape from the belief that it should have been him who was shot in the basement chamber. It should have been him dead on that road to Village Koptiki. His head hung low, his shuffle slow. Misha crossed into the living room, muttering as he so often had, "Lord, forgive me, but first make me suffer. I am the devil's creation. Torture me and make me cry out for mercy, but make me suffer." Entering his office, he paused and admired the wall of books on his Nikolai and Alexandra, some 300 volumes altogether. His will stipulated that these should be donated to Yale for their— Misha's eyes suddenly caught a magazine wedged between two books. Oh, my dear God, he thought, his heart jumping in pace. Didn't I get rid of that? Apparently not. He placed the water glass on the edge of his desk, then pulled down a worn and well-read issue of Esquire magazine that had appeared 5 years ago. He flipped it open to a dog-eared page, and even though Misha had read and reread the piece,
he couldn't stop himself from once again studying the article entitled, What Really Happened That Dark Night. Nothing before had ever come so close to the truth. Nothing had ever scared him so much, and his eyes flew through the entire lengthy piece, scanning every paragraph until he came to the last few. Although unlikely, one or possibly two of Nicholas and Alexandra's children could have survived that horrible night of July 16th to 17th, 1918. Between the time of the execution and their nefarious burial miles away, anything could have happened. Many suspect a guard discovered that one of the girls was alive and pulled her from the truck as it passed down that dark dirt road to the Four Brothers' mine. After all, while the bodies of five Romanovs have recently been found and identified, the bodies of two of the children, Alexei and Maria, are still missing. Where are they? What happened to them? Yurovsky, the commandant in charge of the execution, later claimed to have burned them and scattered their remains, but this, say scientists, is doubtful, for it is impossible to completely cremate a body over an open fire. The theories abound, of course. Some say that Maria was later spotted on a train headed for China. Others, including survivors from a nearby monastery, claim she wandered Siberia until her death in 1973. While it is extremely unlikely that Alexei, a hemophiliac, could have survived the brutal events that took place in the basement of the Ipatiev house, one of the more interesting hypotheses is that he simply wasn't there at all. Rather, a handful of people believe that he switched places with the kitchen boy, Leonid Sedniyov, who was about his age and height. Disguised, Alexei was then, they say, spirited out of the house just hours before his family was murdered. If the young Sedniyov was killed in his place, if Alexei did in fact survive, if he did in fact go on to live to the age of 17, was he, as Rasputin had predicted, completely cured? And if so, how long did he live, and where? Was he, as some suspect, the mysterious hermit monk sometimes spotted lurking in the forest outside Yekaterinburg? Perhaps. Then again, we'll never know. Misha slammed shut the magazine. He had to get rid of it. Sure, his granddaughter Kate might find a copy on her own, but he, sure as the devil, wasn't going to leave one right here in his office for her to discover. He'd been a fool to keep it here this long. And with that, Misha folded the magazine in half and threw it in his leather-embossed trash can. He'd been so thorough, tried to be so complete, and yet... He found himself leaning against his wall of cherished books. These volumes, which included everything from the Tsar and Tsaritsa's last diaries to the letters of Queen Victoria, were like friends to him. Individually, each one contained a snippet of the truth, while their knowledge combined did contain the greater part. And it flashed through his mind, just a look. Sure, and rather like an addict, his hands started shaking. Just one quick look. Pulling a brass key from his pocket, he moved a few feet to the side and yanked out two books in particular, revealing a lock. He was just about to insert the key and unlock his vault when he caught himself. No, he thought, not yet. If I go into that small chamber, I'll be swept away by memories, and I'll never finish the tape. And finish I must. He slipped the key back into the pocket of his trousers and parked the books back in front of the lock. He hadn't been in there since 3 days before May had died, when he'd brought his wife down for what turned out to be her final visit. Absolutely no one but May and he knew of the vault's existence, yet Kate, whom he loved so dearly, soon would. Within a short time, the contents thereof would be all her responsibility. Misha only prayed that the audio tape he was now making, and the sealed letter he'd left with his attorney, would be enough to guide her. In any case, it would soon be out of his control. He'd done everything he could, not only during his lifetime, but to control things from the grave. Sitting down at his desk, Misha took a brief sip of water. With a deep rumble, he cleared his throat, and then he pushed the button on the tape recorder and continued.
Hi, my sweet Kate. It's me, your old dedushka Misha. I'm back. Is my story making sense?
Are you able to follow everything? If there's anything that doesn't make sense, don't forget to check the documents in my dossier. Okay, Malinka?
Little one.
You know, many people many times have said to me how much Russians and Americans are alike. We both have such big hearts, we are both so welcoming into our homes, we are both so desperate to be liked. And sure, in these ways we resemble each other. I do not know, perhaps it is because both countries are so vast and hold such a diversity of peoples, but the similarities stop there. The truth is that Americans cannot possibly begin to understand the depth of the Russian soul, the Orthodox soul. And this you must to understand. For my story to make sense, you must comprehend that every Russian, in his heart of hearts, believes that sin brings suffering, great suffering. That, in turn, leads to repentance. And it is that very cleansing which eventually delivers one closer unto the feet of God himself. Do not forget, sin, repentance, holy deliverance. Sin, torment and cleansing, purification. Sin, suffering, forgiveness. Clear? My passport says I am now an American, but in my heart I know I am and will always be Ruski. And like every other person of my country, I want to judge, I want to blame, I want to point away from myself and say, there, that is the guilty fool, that person did that to me, and my fatherland, he is at fault, not me. It's true, so very true, we Russians are peasants, mere peasants who will do anything to escape blame and responsibility, for we are still deathly afraid of our master's whip. But in fact, the dynasty itself exploded for a myriad of stupidly brilliant reasons. Simply, it somehow stumbled upon a perfect, and yet altogether not random, chemical reaction. You take one part decent man but not enlightened ruler, one part heartbroken mother clutching for any way to save her son, two parts inbred dynasty, and gossip-obsessed court, one part great war, and three parts uneducated, worn, and hungry people, and boom, what do you get? Revolution. Terrible, terrible revolution, of course. Any idiot can see that. It amazes me still to this day how quickly the empire fell to pieces. One day, the people are kissing the ground upon which the Tsar's shadow has fallen, the next, they are hacking apart his body. Nikolai merely put down his scepter and walked away, and literally overnight a 300-year-old dynasty evaporated. Poof, gone, with no one lifting a finger to save it. Ironic that the Soviet Union collapsed just as easily, which proves it was no better, that the cure, communism, was in fact far worse than the disease itself. Now I can only hope those days are over. And just maybe that's true. After all, it took nearly 100 years for the insanity to fade from France after their revolution. So, anyway, where was I? Ah, sure, he said, leaning forward and checking the tape, which was whirring away. I must continue my dark story. You must listen while I tell of the terrible things I saw the night the Romanovs were murdered. I have lived with this story every day, every moment of my life, yet never did I want these events to cross my lips. But now, because of recent developments, tell I must. You see, the night the Romanovs were killed, I chased after the truck that was overflowing with trupe, carcasses, as it slowly headed down that dirt road to village Kaptiki. But I will get to all of those gruesome details. Now, just listen, as I return to the morning of June 26th, 1918. 9. It was a Wednesday. The previous day, the second note had come, so nicely hidden in the cork of that chetvert of milk. And then, that afternoon, I'd carried out the long reply. We were all quite hopeful, even quite expectant, that Wednesday morning. We'd had no news from the outside for weeks. No letters, no newspapers, except an ersatz journal that consisted of 3 telegrams reprinted on some greasy brown paper. But suddenly, there was that candle of hope. Perhaps the world had not forgotten His Majesty after all. Though the morning was hot, very hot again, 22.5 degrees in the room, recorded Alexandra in her diary. We were all quite eager upon rising, thankful to know that someone was apparently working on our behalf. Could it be that God had finally heard the long, sorrowful prayers of Alexandra and her family? Had she finally gotten right her arrangements of icons? I was in the kitchen, stuffing the center of the samovar with twigs and pine cones. It was not quite 7:30, and the first of the Romanovs to go to the water closet that morning, accompanied by a guard, of course, was again the second daughter, Tatyana Nikolaevna. Our eyes met and said the same things. Yes, perhaps today was the day. Perhaps by eve we would be free. Her fine lips pursed the smallest of smiles. Carrying a sponge, toothbrush, rubber traveling bowl, and a pressed white linen hand towel, she, with the guard right behind her, passed through the kitchen, past the 23 steps, and to the far corner of the house. In the back of my mind, I heard the door of the water closet open, close, and knew that the guard was waiting right outside the door while the Grand Duchess was performing her morning ablutions. Several moments later, however, I heard the door of the water closet thrown open, and then Tatyana Nikolaevna, like a fast-moving summer storm, swept back through the kitchen, her eyes cast to the floor. There were bright blooms of red spread across her face, again so much like her mother, whose emotions manifested themselves physically, while behind her came the guard, laughing deeply as he stroked his stringy beard. What untoward actions had he taken? Had he cornered the young woman, tried to kiss her, as one of them had tried to embrace Maria just last week? I glanced through the hall into the dining room. I saw nothing, but heard a flurry of low voices, the swishing of dresses. A few moments passed before Nikolai Alexandrovich himself came storming along the same route, wearing his army tunic and tall leather boots, of course. He passed through the kitchen, his face grave. Behind him came the same guard, still laughing, still stroking his beard. Although I was all but invisible to both of them, I watched as the ex-Tsar moved with great determination into the water closet. He remained there longer than his daughter. A good deal longer. I lit the samovar, vented the smoke out the window. I blew on the twigs, made sure the flame was fine and strong. And then I heard Nikolai Alexandrovich emerge, heard him march my way, his pace steady, controlled, firm, almost like a robot he passed me by, his face stony and void of expression. Many people have described the Tsar as such, that when bad news was delivered upon him, they were surprised by his lack of reaction, lack of emotion. Some great ministers and foreign dignitaries mistook this as a lack of caring and feeling, a weak-willed passivity, or deep-seated fatalism, but they were all wrong. Nikolai Alexandrovich was deeply emotional, extraordinarily caring, and also a firm believer that the Tsar of all the Russias must maintain absolute control, control of every little item on his desk, control of his own calendar and appointments, and above all, supreme among most manly things, control of his personal feelings. All this, while deep inside so much was seething, all of which he expressed only to his wife. Yes, a passionate, loving man, which is made clear in the thousands of letters he left behind. But as he moved on by, Not an inkling of emotion could I detect on that man's practiced face. I did notice something, however. His hands. They were blackened, and he was rubbing them together, trying desperately to wipe something away. Unable to contain myself, I quickly peered into the center of the samovar and saw that the blaze was going well. I then glanced into the dining room, spying nothing. While all of the Romanovs needed a guard to escort them to the water closet or the bathing room, I did not, and so that is exactly where I went, to the very place where the Tsar had just gone on foot. Passing through the house, I reached the far corner, where I paused, heard the guards' deep voices. Was that groggy one Komandant Avdeev? Then reached for the door of the water closet, and thereupon entered a small chamber of surprise. Russians can be witty, they can be cruel, and they find keen delight in the grotesque marriage of the two. Many things had I heard in jest about Nikolai. We had a revolution, not because we wanted a limited monarchy, but because we had a limited monarch. But here, on the walls of the water closet, were things that my youthful mind had never conjured. On the wall, across from the ceramic sink, was painted a demonic man, his hair long and scraggly, his beard twisted and foul. He was naked, and rising from between his legs was a gigantic erect penis, which he was shoving into the crack of a woman, who herself wore nothing but a large bejeweled crown. Above him was written the name Grisha, while on her crown was inscribed Shura. Sure, in this tiny chamber, the angry red guards had portrayed the man they believed had soiled the dynasty and brought down the empire, Grigory Rasputin, fornicating with that traitor to the motherland, the German bitch, Empress Alexandra Fyodorovna. Nearby, watching the scene with robust delight, was an effeminate, chubby, bearded man with droopy breasts, the Emperor Nikolai II, who sat in a tub overflowing with German marks and American dollars. It was done in big, bold strokes of black paint, permanent paint. That much was obvious, because the Tsar had used a wet hand to try to wipe it away, though it had proved impossible to do little more than lightly smear the graphic mural. But there was more. Most of the guards had never before seen a toilet, let alone used one, and had taken to using this one by standing on the seat itself and squatting. In light of the numerous muddy footprints left behind on the seat, the Empress had had her maid place a cultured sign above the toilet that read, "Be so kind as to leave the toilet as clean as you found it." But that did little good, because most of the guards couldn't read either. In any case, to the side, and written directly on the wall, was a little ditty. To all his peoples, Nikolai said, "As for a republic, go fuck yourselves instead. So our Russian Tsar called Nick, we dragged from his throne by his dick." To myself, I mumbled aloud the last two lines. Tsaria Ruskava Nikolu, Zahuis Dyornulis Pristolu. And I began to shake. Such rudeness was unbelievable. To this day, it is still forbidden in Russia to even publish the word Hui. And I started to cry, not so much out of fear, but because, for the first time, I grasped how horrid a world lay ahead if, in fact, I survived. Yes, the image and little ditty remained all the way to the end, and in fact were added to as the days fell away, with slogans like, "Crush the crowns of the Tsar, tear apart the old world. Death to the blood drinker. To hell with capitalism. Crush international imperialism." All these did the Romanovs see in the water closet, day after day. Whenever they went to relieve themselves, they were surrounded with this hatred. I have no idea what they thought, what they felt, as they, father, mother, son, and daughters, went into that small chamber one after the other and sat there alone and half-naked, as the hatred bore down upon them from all sides. And yet, the Romanovs suffered well. Not a protest did they make. Not a word did they complain. They read their Bibles, they chanted their prayers, they bowed to their icons. Yet that morning, there was still a chance of rescue. And a chance meant hope. No, Nikolai did not want to be rescued from that special house and restored to the brilliancy of the Romanov throne. Of this I am absolutely certain. If so many of his peoples felt locked in the chains of poverty, then he felt entrapped by the riches of the dynasty, which is to say that peasant and Tsar alike were liberated by the revolution. Yes, many have said, and I do believe it to be true, that Nikolai bloomed after his abdication. The call of nature ruled all, of course, and one by one, all of the Romanovs visited the water closet by 8 of that morning, that is to say, within the 30 minutes left before our inspection. Not a word of protest did they make, however, at least not outwardly, not that could be heard by any of their guards, or even us, their small retinue, consisting of Dr. Botkin, the maid Demidova, the footman Trup, the cook Haritonov, and me, the kitchen boy. I watched all the rest of them, the Empress, the heir Tsarevich, and the other 3 daughters, as they passed through the kitchen to the facilities, escorted, as they all were, by a guard. To generalize, if they appeared full of trepidation as they headed for the toilet room, then they seemed shocked upon their return. In all that I've learned, the thing that surprised Nikolai and Alexandra the most about his abdication, the one aspect that crushed their hearts, was definitely not the loss of power and wealth, but the realization of how widely hated they were. And by this I mean not by the court, but the narod, the masses, whose emotions were so deeply stirred by the centuries of inequity and darkly spiced by the poisonous propaganda of the Bolsheviki. So, the inspection that morning was a somber affair. The only visible sign of stress among the family were Alexandra's eyes, which were swollen red, and her pale skin, which was all blotchy. But while she was deeply disturbed that morning, perhaps deathly afraid, she would not betray herself. She would not allow her captors that victory, not simply over her persona, but most importantly over her faith in the greater glory of Bog, God. She knew as well that she had to be strong for her children, the children whom she had always tried to raise properly, so that they would not folly in their wealth and exalted status. To them she wrote, "Learn to make others happy. Think of yourself last of all. Be gentle and kind, never rough or rude. Show a loving heart. Above all, learn to love God with all the force of your soul, and He will be near you. Your old mama." Standing, according to our rank, from Tsar to Tsaritsa, heir to Grand Duchesses, then all the way from doctor, maid, and down to me, the lowest of all, that morning inspection was the most somber of any to take place in the house of special purpose. We stood in the dining room, in front of the large fireplace, all of us seething with rage and fear, but none of us saying a word, because we took our every cue from the Emperor and Empress. When they crossed themselves during a church service, so did we. When they dropped to their knees and bowed their foreheads to the floor, so did we. And that morning, during that inspection, both Nikolai and Alexandra stood ramrod straight, their lips pinched tight like a champagne cork holding all within, lest all explode. And so did we.
"No, no."
"Well, well," mumbled Aviv, looking us up and down.
Big and heavy was he, his hair a mess, his face unshaved. Actually, his eyes were red as well, though certainly not from crying. Нет.